Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
That war rocket Ajax to bring back his body.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts. My name is Chris Sims, and with me as always is Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, how are you on this fine stormy evening?
I'm good. I'm not having a storm. It's quite calm. But so you're stormy and I'm calm. That's how we are.
Usually the case. Usually the case.
old stormy and calm, they call us.
You are a steadfast constant, and I am just always on the verge of emotional collapse.
Well, that's a great way to start a show. We have a great one.
That's right, Matt. We do have a great one. Matt, if people are just tuning in for the very first time, what do we do here on this show?
We talk to the luminaries, the brilliant minds, the shining lights in the world of comics and comic book culture, and we have one of those very luminaries on the show this week, Fred Van Lente, who we've had on the show several times before, talking about comics that he has written. This time around, we're doing something a little different. We're talking to him about his new novel, his debut novel, in fact, 10 Dead Comedians, which is about a different kind of comic, which we'll get into how that word can be used interchangeably in the interview. It's a really good book, a really fun, I guess you'd call it a locked room mystery, a who's the killer kind of story. Really fun read. It's a page turner, and I think folks are going to like it. We're going to talk about the origins of it and the characters and all of that, and novel writing. He and I talk about the books we have written and published this year. So that's going to be a fun time. But before we talk to Fred, Chris, we've got some business to take care of, as we often do, starting with thanking our newest supporters on Patreon.
That's right, Matt. These are the people who have gone to patreon.com/warrocketajax, and they are helping us out by kicking in as little as a dollar every month to keep those lights on and pay those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills.
This week we just have one person to thank, and that's Dylan Burdett.
Dylan, thank you.
If you would like to do what Dylan did, you can kick in as little as $1 over at patreon.com/warrocketajax. And you can get some cool stuff. You can get ad-free episodes of the show. You can get exclusive art, like what we just sent out from Jordan Witt, which was some really cool art that only patrons get to see. Bonus audio if you're at a certain level. You get line-stepping privileges for all our lists that we do. And other cool stuff. So,
and Matt, you mentioned the bonus audio, and I want to make it clear that we're talking about, like, basically additional episodes of the show. Sometimes Matt and I will just talk to each other, and honestly, we should be dining out on that Garfield Con bonus content for quite some time. It is very intense.
It is very intense. Sometimes I will take outtakes from the show or little bits from the interviews that wouldn't fit in a regular episode and throw them up on there as bonus content. But lately we've been recording like half hour, 45 minute chunks and putting them up as bonus content. And we want to do one where we talk about Breath of the Wild, the new Zelda game. So if any of that sounds cool to you, go over to Patreon and kick some money in. And you'll get that stuff. All right, Chris, now that we've done that, let's do some checks and recs. Chris, what are you checking in with this week?
Well, Matt, I have been just continuing my odyssey through the public library. And I gotta say, there's good things and bad things. Good is that I finished up the book I was reading last week, and I started in on, I'd say she's a friend of the show, Jennifer Wright's new book, Get Well Soon. I started reading that one. It's a very good time if you like reading about plagues through a witty historical perspective.
Certainly so, a friend of bonus content because she's been in some.
That book is super fun and highly recommended so far. I haven't finished it yet, so I can't give it a full rec. The bad part is that I am like number 52 on the waiting list for the library's only copy of John Wick 2. So it's probably going to be a while before that one's my rec.
I mean, look, the Redbox costs $1.25.
I know what the Redbox costs, Matt. I'm broke. I've considered it, but like I'm also like getting some other stuff here and there. We've got Crimson Peak in the living room right now to give it a watch sometime this weekend. Is it? It's not scary though, right?
It's not. There are ghosts, but I wouldn't say it's scary. No.
Okay. Well, Matt, what do I not like?
You don't like scary movies.
I don't like scary movies. So yeah, that's going to be, the library giveth and then giveth also, but a little slower, but there's one more thing I wanted to talk about. Like that's what I've been up to in my life, but I want to talk about what you are up to in your lives. You, the listeners,
Ooh. We've
been hearing a lot about people having War Rocket Ajax dreams, and I want to hear more.
This started with a Tumblr. What in our question box, but it was a comment where somebody got on there. I don't remember if they were anonymous or not, but they got on there and told us about how they dreamed about us. They had a War Rocket Ajax dream. That led to several descriptions of War Rocket Ajax dreams on Tumblr. And we got maybe the weirdest War Rocket Ajax dream story very recently in an email. That one came from Wednesday Sophia, and I don't know if they want a sharing their dream.
It was not marked okay to print.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna hold off on it. I mean, it wasn't like it was just like dream weird. It wasn't like
it was
dirty or anything before anybody gets the wrong idea.
Yes.
But if you have been having War Rocket Ajax dreams. Movie fighters dreams, snack situation dreams. I want to hear about them. Sailor business dreams and Xena business dreams too. But Matt, I'm sure, does not care unless it's the episode that Matt's on of Xena business.
Yeah, when I surprise you.
You did. It was wonderful. Everyone should go listen to it. It was a true delight. So here's the thing: if you've had a War Rocket Ajax dream, tell us. Email us. Tweet at us. Put it in the Tumblr, leave it as a comment on the show, tell us, I want to hear about it. But don't, like, make it up. Like, don't make up a War Rocket Ajax dream, because I'll be able to tell, trust me. And don't make it weird, and you know what I'm talking about. But yeah, that's what I'm up to this week, Matt. Scattershot, as usual, what have you been up to?
Well, I'm going to make mine scattershot, too. I got a direct message from somebody, Leo Zippin.
I was just really hoping the entire text of your check this week was, I got a DM.
I got one direct message. No, I got a direct message from somebody who wanted to talk to me about what I was talking about last week when I talked about Wonder Woman. And the complaint I had about the accents on Themyscira. And Leo made the point of – Leo is an Israeli and made the point that a lot of times when Israelis appear in movies, especially big movies, their accent is really changed to the point where it's not identifiable as an Israeli accent or it's made into something else. So letting Gal Gadot actually have her real Israeli accent was super cool for him. And I totally get that. And I am absolutely – I want to make it very clear. I'm absolutely not at all against Gal Gadot having her accent in that movie. It was fine and not a problem. The only thing I thought was weird was that everybody else had to also do it, when she could just have her accent and nobody should mind. Like, it should be okay. So
yeah, I mean, I think what you said was that you wish that just everybody had their natural normal accent.
I thought I made that clear, but if I didn't make it that clear, I want to apologize and say, at no point did I mean to imply that I thought Gal Gadot should have been trying to do something other than her own accent, because I think she should have, and it was totally fine for her to talk that way. So I wanted to say that. Also, I want to talk really quickly about book signings. I should have mentioned this last week, but it's already happened now. I did a signing in Lexington, Kentucky over the weekend at Collectibles, etc. They've been doing some great promotion for it. I'm sure it was great. If, as I've said before, if you know some folks at a local bookstore or comic shop and you would like me to come do a signing of Supreme Villainy, I have plenty of copies of the book, so your local store doesn't even necessarily have to order them. I can just show up, have the books with me, sign them and sell them there. Let me know. Get in touch. I know some people have gotten in touch with me to let me know about different stores that I should get in touch with. Some of those have panned out. Maybe some of those haven't. But if you know, like, somebody at a store and would like me to come sign Supreme Villainy there, certainly, absolutely let me know about that. I am excited and eager to go do more signings. So keep me in mind if you know somebody at a comic shop or a bookstore where I can do those things. And thanks to Collectibles, etc. for hosting me. Let's make some recommendations. What do you have to recommend?
Well, I am going to make one of the most enthusiastic recommendations I have made on this show, and that is for Spider-Man Homecoming, the new film about the Spider-Man, Peter Parker. Here's the problem. Matt, you haven't seen it yet.
I haven't seen it yet, no.
And it's still relatively new, so I wouldn't want to spoil it for you, the listener, either.
If there's anything that would convince you that I am a guy who cannot stand going to movie theaters on opening weekends, I haven't seen Spider-Man Homecoming yet.
I'm telling you, we went at 11 a.m. It was great. That's morning movies. And I realize this is not an option for everyone, because not everyone can just fuck off from their job.
Yeah.
But if you have the option, morning movies, even like a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning, oh, those early movies, it's so choice. It's so, so good. And I will say, even at 11 a.m., a lot of people in the theater, but people who were there to watch a friggin' movie. Matt, I will predict. And I can, you can take this to the bank. I'll bet you $50 you're going to love this movie. And you know I'm serious, because that's a legitimate amount of money that I would be able to scrape together for you.
I mean, if you did not. I'm not going to take that bet, because I expect to love it. I expect to really enjoy it. Based on everything I've heard, based on how much I loved Tom Holland, Spider-Man in Captain America Civil War, you know, based on everything I've seen, and that poster that is Amazing Fantasy, the Amazing Fantasy number 15 cover. Oh, yeah,
why was that not just the poster?
Oh boy, that's great.
The worst thing about that movie is some of those posters that they had. There have been some very, very good ones. There's a Breakfast Club one that's really good. Here's what I will say, and I will keep things vague so as to not spoil it for you. Like, honest to God, think it is the best MCU movie. And that's, you know, it's the most recent one, and there's a couple I haven't seen. But Cap 2 used to be my favorite, and I feel like this is the one. Like, it's better than Guardians. There is a part where I cried in the theater. As soon as I got out of the theater, I called Chad. It is the same part where he cried in the movie theater.
Okay.
Because we had both seen it. I think he saw a 10:30 show and I saw an 11 a.m. show, both with our wives. And we apparently did the exact same, like, lean forward onto our knees and cover our mouths motion at this moment. And you will know exactly where it was that I cried.
Do you predict that I will cry?
I don't know. Like, okay, look, I'm a soft touch at movies. Like, you know that part in the first Sam Raimi Spider-Man movie where, like, the guy throws the garbage at Green Goblin and says, if you mess with one of us, you mess with all of us? Like, I started crying then.
You mean the most manipulative
post
9/11 moment in a movie?
It always works on me, Matt. It always works. Like, I cried at Rise of the Guardians when all those kids had to believe in Santa Claus. Oh, it got me. I don't know if you will cry, but I know that there will be, I know that it will affect you.
Okay. I am a softer touch than I used to be. I find myself tearing up at stuff in movies that I never would have done that for in the past. I think that's just something that happens as you get older. But yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I don't think I've actually cried at a movie in a long time, though. So,
and this is the last thing I'll say. And I don't really consider this a spoiler because I'm going to keep it in pretty vague terms. But again, you will not believe the amount of Spider-Man characters who show up in this movie, and you will not believe which Spider-Man characters show up in this movie.
So, in other words, be real excited for the kangaroo to hop in.
Matt, the kangaroo wasn't in it, but I would not have been surprised by the end of that movie. This is the first comic book movie I've seen that involves characters I've written, because I haven't seen Guardians 2 yet. I'm going to go see that this weekend. So that was a surprise and a little bit of a thrill for me. But that's it. Homecoming is fucking great. Go see it if you haven't already. Matt, you should go see it as soon as you can.
Okay.
We almost saw it the day after we saw it. Like, Aiden wanted to go see it that Saturday, but we didn't have time.
I will go see it as soon as I can. Yeah, that is my promise.
What is your rec?
My rec is a movie that a lot of people slept on. And a lot of people, including myself.
Homecoming.
One that I thought about going to see when it was in theaters and just didn't. One I thought about getting at the Redbox and just didn't. And then it popped up on HBO Now. And I was like, oh, let's watch this. It's Pop Star. Never Stop, Never Stopping. The Lonely Island, sorta, maybe, kinda, parody of Justin Bieber's career. Or maybe Justin Timberlake's career. Or maybe a big mix of different, like, super famous musicians. It's, you know, it stars Andy Samberg. And it's got the two other Lonely Island guys in supporting roles. They both directed it, Akiva Schaffer and Jorma Taccone. I'll just say this. At the end of the movie, when we finished the movie, my lovely wife Marlene said, well, that was silly.
I can hear her saying it.
And that's true. But I loved that. Because something that I kind of thought about after that was, I don't know when the last time I saw just a silly comedy was. Like, let me be clear. Popstar is not just like a full-on parody. It's not like, you know, Naked Gun-style madcap stuff the whole time, even though there are, like, cutaway things, and the songs are very goofy. Like, the songs are probably the silliest, goofiest part of the whole movie. But, you know, there's like a bit of drama that occurs in the movie. Because I feel like you can't get away with a comedy that doesn't have at least a hint of drama in it now. But it's the silliest comedy I've seen in a long time. And I feel like silly comedies are something that just don't happen anymore. I don't know how the bottom fell out of silly comedy movies, but they are not in vogue. Something about the Judd Apatow comedy movie engine has kind of driven them out of movies. Like your Farrelly Brothers kind of movies, or like full-on parody. Like, parody movies are more than dead. And I'm sure that's just because of like your superhero movie and disaster movie and teen movie, and there's like bottom feeding cheap parody movies that were coming out a few years ago. But Popstar is one of the better examples of like a silly comedy that doesn't really take itself very seriously, where the characters are way over the top and there's lots of cameos. Like Bill Hader shows up for one scene where he's the guitar tech, which where he does some really funny physical bits. There's a whole like TMZ parody thing that has Will Arnett, Eric Andre, Mike Birbiglia,
and Chelsea Peretti.
They're all in the scene together, and those scenes maybe take up a sum total of like 3 minutes of screen time, if even, probably 2 minutes of screen time. So it's just packed with jokes, and I loved that about it. And we just laughed really hard at parts of the movie. And it's a movie that you can watch and at the end be like, that was very silly. But at the same time, sometimes that's the movie you want. And that's kind of the movie that I wanted when I watched Popstar. So if you have an HBO account, there's also the new Andy Samberg Lonely Island movie that's just an HBO movie called Tour to Pharmacy that's on there that I want to watch now too, because we just watched Popstar. But if you haven't seen Popstar and you want a silly comedy, it's a pretty good one. And that's my recommendation, Chris. Let's talk about some comics that came out this week. I think we can agree that the big book of the week is Dark Days, The Casting, number one.
Well, yes. But I would say that the big book of the week for people of very specific sensibilities was Mage, The Hero Denied, number zero.
Yeah.
Which one do you want to talk about first?
Well, okay, we'll talk about Mage Zero. Yes, for a particular type of comics fan, Mage was the big book of the week. It's a landmark book. It's the return of Mage. It's all Matt Wagner doing it. Now, this number zero is kind of short. I think it's maybe 16 pages.
Well, it was only $1.99, too.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, it's an intro issue. It's one of those cheap, get-you-back-in kind of issues. And in that sense, it sort of makes sense that this is sort of a standalone story.
Mm-hmm.
I was sort of expecting it to be more of what I guess modern Zero issues have become, which is like always a prologue to a bigger story. And this may be a prologue to something, to the rest of Mage, the Hero Denied. But as far as this one issue we have, it's very self-contained.
It's a real... It really is like a, oh, hey, do you know about Mage? Here's Kevin Matchstick. Here's what his deal is. He's the Pendragon. He goes around and fights monsters. He's been doing this for a while, and he can turn anything he holds into Excalibur. Yeah. Whether it is a pebble that he throws, or whether it is a road sign that he pulls up out of the dirt and then uses to fight a monster.
Or a street light, which he uses at one point, too.
Yeah. It's very good. But I think this is kind of necessary because as much as people like you and I talk about Mage, and as much as we consider Mage to be like a profoundly influential book on our tastes and on our careers even, it's been a while since we've had a new Mage story. It's been since 2000? It's been like 17 years.
Yeah, for a certain type of comics reader, you know, Mage, or a comics reader of a certain age, Mage is not in their, not on their radar at all. Like, if you didn't read Wizard, you might not be aware of Mage.
We all talk shit about Wizard and damn, but I am one of the ones who has talked the most. But Wizard, somebody working at Wizard was always hype for Usagi Yojimbo and Mage and Bone.
For real.
And that person led a lot of us down a correct path.
And for those of us who do know Mage, it's kind of like, hey, here's where Kevin Matchstick is now, right?
Yeah.
Because he's older, he's maybe a little gruffer, he's lost some hair.
He's bald. He doesn't have a ponytail anymore, and he's bald. Because Matt Wagner is also bald.
He's clearly older, right? Uh-huh. And the interesting conceit of this issue is that Kevin Matchstick is teaming up with one of those damn millennials.
He really is. He really is one of those damn millennials.
One of those damn millennials with a Walkman on his belt.
Okay, here's a it's not even really a secret about Mage. Like, almost all of the characters are based on other people in comics. Like Joe Fat was Joe Matt. Kirby Hero was Bernie Moreau. Jeff Loeb shows up in one of these, I think. Is it John Francis Moore who's the presbyter? But I really want to know who this guy is. I really want to know who Matt Wagner was sitting next to at a con that bugged him so much that he became this guy who Kevin Matchstick has to save from these little shitty goblins in this issue.
The fact that he is such a 1990s teenager.
Uh-huh.
Who's very much supposed to be in the modern day.
Uh-huh.
From some creators, that would be annoying or off-putting.
Oh, yeah, totally.
In this, it's endearing.
It's, if it was anyone else, if it was Matt Wagner in another book, I think it would be like, oh my god. Oh my god. But it really, like, it's charming here. It's fun, you know?
It makes me wonder if this is supposed to be a period piece. If this is supposed to take place in 1995. You know?
Well, I mean, theoretically, it could be taking place in, like, what, 2002? If we're picking right up off of The Hero Defined?
I mean, Kevin Matchstick is clearly much older, as we said, but
Matt, he gets all of his hair blown off with magic lightning at the end of The Hero Defined. Did you forget that?
That's right, he does. So it could be right after. It could be. But yeah, Walkmans were maybe a little out of date by 2002. Let's be real.
Point being, this book's $2. It's 16 pages of Matt Wagner doing a new Mage prelude. If you haven't read the earlier two volumes of Mage, they're available digitally, and they were one of the first big books to go up on Comixology back in, like, 2010. So get on Mage, I think, is our collective recommendation on this one.
Also, Image, along with this, Image has just released a new collection of Mage, The Hero Discovered.
Oh, good.
New Volume 1 trade paperback. So I'm assuming more of those are going to be coming out as the series comes out. So you can get caught up with brand new reprintings of the old Mage.
All right, so now let's move on to the casting.
Okay, so this book was weird. This book was super weird. And strangely Morrison-y. Did you get that vibe from it?
I did, because it's one of those we're going to tie it all together books.
Yes.
But it's also one of those Batman's going to take this magic dagger and go on a quest books.
Yeah, what's weird is it's we're going to tie all this together. Like, we're going to tie all the very recent Batman history together stories. Yeah. Like the machine that rebooted his brain.
Oh, the final machine?
The final machine, yes.
Batman's final invention? Yeah, yeah. That's the one.
So we should give the credits. Scott Snyder and James Tynion are the writers on this. And then there are three semi-intersecting storylines that are drawn by Andy Kubert, Jim Lee, and John Romita Jr. However, it reaches a point where Andy Kubert's just drawing the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's almost kind of a jarring moment, because all the stuff that's taking place in the Batcave is drawn by Jim Lee, until it's not. And then Andy Kubert's just drawing everything.
Right.
Which makes me think that Kubert just kind of came on and said, like, I'll just finish it up. We've got three different artists drawing three different stories. We've got a Hawkman thing going on that Kubert is drawing at the beginning, which is obviously the worst part of the whole thing because it's Hawkman.
Oh, no, I don't want to go read a Hawkman thing. Yeah, well, this Hawkman thing ends with Batman going on a quest with a magic sword. So, you know, you take the good, you take the bad.
Well, it's
the presence of Hawkman.
Okay, well, if you want to talk about tying everything together,
mm-hmm.
It feels like this book is an explanation of Nth Metal.
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel like that is what DC Metal is.
Yeah.
Because it's literally about Nth Metal and about, like, magic metals and magic swords and stuff.
Yeah, it's not about, like, metaphorical metal. It's about literal metal. The material. And, like, Batman has become obsessed with it. So in the scenes with Batman, drawn by John Romita Jr., which look badass, with him and Wonder Woman, he is just talking about, like, I gotta get my hands on this metal. Like, Wonder Woman, you have to help me get, because I'm obsessed with metal now.
But I mean, like you said, it is kind of tying a bunch of stuff together. Like the Dionysium from Endgame, and I guess from the Electrum from the Court of Owls stuff before that. Like, look, Matt, you know that I am, like, a DC Universe minutia guy. Like, I will talk to you about Soda Cola and Big Belly Burger, like, in Curtains 98 every goddamn day of the week. So I'm loving it. I am reveling in this stuff.
And then it's also tying the Joker into it, because all the Jim Lee drawn parts take place in the Batcave. You've got Hal Jordan and Duke. The Joker's in prison in the Batcave. They're kind of watching over the Joker. And then there's this whole thing where the Joker gives this long monologue where he's basically saying, hey, I'm the good guy in this. I'm trying to warn you about bad stuff that's about to happen. Oh, and also
where the Joker talks about traveling backwards in time, that's the most Morrison-y thing in there.
Yeah, that's super Morrison-y. But also, like, Duke having metal in his blood.
Yeah. Oh, are you talking about how metahumans are actually metal humans?
Yes.
Yeah, that shit was buck wild. I love it.
It's very, like, that stuff is super Morrison-y to me.
It is that perfect, like, midpoint between Morrison and Johns. Because
kind of right.
Metahumans are actually metal humans, but there are only four letters in the computer. That's some fucking Geoff Johns shit all day long, but I love it because it's in the context of this super weird tie it all together stuff that I think is really working. Because we've been talking about this book for a minute now, and we haven't even talked about how the challenge was the unknown or in it.
They sure are, and that's tied into the Hawkman stuff.
Yeah, Hawkman and the Challenge is the Unknown. That's kind of rad. I'm kind of on its side.
Also, how maybe the Green Lantern rings are tied into the metal, too? Because Hal gives Duke his ring, and Duke can use it.
He gives Duke a ring. I don't think he gives him his, because
him,
one of the old...
He gives him a backup copy. Okay.
One of the things that the old Green Lantern rings could do, because I remember this because Kyle couldn't do it, was that Green Lantern rings can make more Green Lantern rings, which is super weird. Again, that's that DC Universe minutia that I have stocked my brain with over the past 30 years.
This book is, like, if you're not into DC Comics minutia, you will not care about this at all. But if that is the kind of thing you are into, it's ambrosia. Like, you could just lap it up. And you can hear, like, kind of the excitement in our voices as we talk about this. Like, this is the kind of stuff we really love.
Yeah. Yeah. You've heard us talk about every story ever in Panel President. This is This is what we're into. But yeah, like I really liked the Forge. I really liked the casting. The other thing that's like super Jonesy, but like I absolutely love it. What is it? The dark days are over. The dark nights are coming.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hell yes. Hell yes. Give this to me.
Finally, I want to talk a little bit about Spider-Man 2, number one, the sequel miniseries to the original Spider-Man series with the same creative team of Brian Michael Bendis and Sarah Pacelli. In that first miniseries, there was a leap because Peter Parker had to go from his universe to the Ultimate Universe to meet Miles Morales. Now they live in the same universe, so they can go across town from each other and meet up. So it's less about the universe traveling stuff. However, it ties into the events of that previous miniseries because there's some leftover fallout from that jump between dimensions. So we've got Miles and Peter kind of dealing with that. But it feels like what the big reveal is going to be in here is that the original Marvel Universe had its own Miles, and we haven't seen him yet. So what's his deal? Who is this other Miles? And what, you know, what does he know? Is he older? Like, you know, Marvel Universe Peter was older than Ultimate Universe Peter? I feel like that's going to be the big question of the series. The end of the issue kind of has a cliffhanger about it, and that's super interesting to me. I'm really hyped to see what, you know, original Marvel U Miles Morales is, what his deal is going to be. And, you know, I think we talked on this show before about how Bendis can be kind of hit or miss for us. Some Bendis stuff we really like, some Bendis stuff, you know, we feel is not so much his forte. I do feel like Spider-Man is very much his forte, because he did, you know, all the Ultimate Spider-Man series with Peter. He's written virtually every comic that Miles Morales has been the star of, aside from some team books. And so he has Miles Morales' voice so down, so perfectly correct. And he's really good at writing Peter Parker, too. So when those two characters get together, just reading the dialogue is kind of a treat. I feel like we're living in a really good age of Spider-Man dialogue, where we have, you know, Bendis writing stuff like this. We have Chip writing his own Spider-Man book. And, like, Dan Slott has never been a slouch in writing Spider-Man dialogue either. He's been on the book forever. So I feel like, you know, we're kind of reaching that point of, like, okay, Dan, your time's up. But he's never gotten bad at writing Spider-Man dialogue. So, you know, we're in that moment. And I think this book's just a really great example of it. Sarah Pacelli's a fantastic artist. Like, the fact that her Miles has aged a little bit over time. Like, he's clearly a couple years older than he was in the last Spider-Man series. And I think that's fantastic. I just, like, the coloring in this book is great, too. And unfortunately, I don't remember who the colorist on this was. But just a great-looking book. Well-written. And I like the main mystery of it. Good, good stuff. Chris, that's our comics review segment. Let's talk to Fred Van Lente about 10 Dead Comedians.
Let's do it. Joining us for the program this week is an old friend of the show, someone that we are always pleased to welcome back. He is one of our favorite writers around in the world of comics, but he's stepping a little bit outside of comics these days with his new book, 10 Dead Comedians. Fred Van Lente is here. Fred, how are you?
Happy to be back, guys. Thank you for having me.
Before we get to your new book, there's something that I want to ask you, because I just recently followed up on something from an interview that I believe you were on 5 years ago.
God, okay. Well, I'll do what I can to help.
So the question is this. What have you been reading lately? Because you always have very interesting things that you've been reading.
The book I literally just finished is called The Cooking Gene. One of the cool things about now being a novelist is I now have an agent, and I get, like, galleys of things, which are, like, the book before the book. And my agent happens to have a bunch of clients. Jason Yarn, who's a terrific agent, has a bunch of clients who write food history. The guy's name is Michael W. Twitty. He wrote a book called The Cooking Gene that's sort of a history of African-American cuisine from the 17th century to today. And it's sort of tracing that, and it's tracing his personal family history, because he's into genealogy, and he had his DNA tested, so he goes to sort of all the places that fed into African-American history. He's sort of like a food Indiana Jones, if you will. And I thought it was terrific, and that's out in a couple months.
Now, is that something that you just grabbed because you were interested in cooking, or just, I know that you're very interested in nonfiction in general.
Yeah, no, I'm a huge history nut, I'm a huge American history nut, and I'm a huge cook. So it kind of hit all my buttons, and Jason Yarn gave me an advanced galley of a book called A Square Meal that just won the James Beard Award for best, I think, nonfiction book, and that was a culinary history of the Great Depression, so I really dug that, and so he gave me Michael Twitty's book, and a lot of that is focused, Chris, on your home state of South Carolina and sort of all the great kind of quaint cuisines that go on there, and I really recommend it if you're into food.
Well, I'm gonna accept that recommendation and give you a recommendation,
go.
Fred.
I'm ready.
Aiden and I just recently went to see John T. Edge do a reading and a talk from his new book, The Potlicker Papers,
okay.
A Food History of the Modern South.
Oh, very nice. The Potlicker Papers.
I have not read the book yet. Aiden, I think, is working her way through it right now, but the talk was very interesting, and he went through sort of the history of food in the South and the different places that have been like communal hubs, like, and how fried chicken was once the, you know, once a week delicacy and is now just a thing people can have all the time with the rise of Kentucky Fried Chicken, and how the new modern Southern food is going to be taquerias, and that's where all the interesting stuff is happening with Southern cooking these days.
I'll buy that.
So what is your go-to recipe? Like, if you want to make something not too difficult, because I've been doing a little more cooking than I have in the past, okay. What's a good, easy weeknight go-to recipe that you enjoy?
I do this thing, I make it all insanely difficult to myself for no reason. What I do is I subscribe to some cooking magazines, and then I get the magazine in the mailbox, right? And then I start from the cover, and then I make everything from cover to cover, and, you know, usually a magazine.
Do you really?
Yeah, I do. And so I end up, and so by the time I finish the magazine, these magazines tend to come out bi-monthly, this next issue showed up. So I throw that out and I start over again. So I very rarely make the same thing twice. One thing I'm really in love with right now is it's a Hawaiian raw salmon salad called poke. It's really terrific. You just need nice cuts of salmon. You chop them up in cubes, and then you make a sauce that's a lot of mirin, which is sort of a sweetened sake. It's like a cooking sake, and ginger, and a bunch of other kind of Asian-y spices, and some scallions and some jalapenos, and it's great, and it takes literally 15 minutes to make. Because you make so much of the sauce, you just keep using it over and over again. So I've been down with the poke. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that incorrectly. I don't know how they say it in Hawaii, but it's raw salmon salad. It's terrific.
Yeah, there's a new poke place in Raleigh that I've had some food from. What are the magazines? I'm going to guess. I'm going to throw a couple out there. You tell me. Bon Appetit has got to be in the mailbox.
You know what? You know what's funny is it's not in the mailbox, but my I just found out my cousin works for Bon Appetit, so she gave me a stack of issues that now I'm burdened with a new magazine that I've got to somehow get to. The one I really like is called Fine Cooking. That a buddy of mine, Jeff, who letters Atomic Robo, his wife turned me on to that magazine, which was terrific. And I did Cook's Country for years, but like I subscribed for like 10 years and I got a little repetitive for me just cause I'd been following it for that long. So I kind of ditched it and stuck to Fine Cooking. But yeah, now I've got I got a stack of Bon Appetit. So I got to get through. Now there's a lot of pressure. Cause now I got like five magazines I got to go through cover to cover. I might have to, like, you know, I might have to vary my OCD with the cooking magazines now that my cousin's introduced the picture and is giving me all this free stuff.
I find this very interesting. I'm sure we will eventually talk about your book, I promise.
Yeah, no, I love
it. I find this...
I could talk about cooking forever.
I feel like I, like a lot of people, first encountered your work alongside Ryan Dunleavy.
Sure.
Because I believe Action Philosophers, I went back and read Silencers after, but I think Action Philosophers was the first thing that I read.
Okay.
And Dunleavy, of course, did the illustrations for Dirt Candy, the vegetarian cookbook.
Yes. And that book was co-written by a guy named Grady Hendrix, who's married to Amanda Cohen, the chef and creator of Dirt Candy. And he is the person who introduced me to Quark Books, for whom I wrote the novel 10 Dead Comedians.
So it all comes together. That's a beautiful segue, Fred.
It all ties together. It's true.
So let's talk about 10 Dead Comedians. I understand Batman is not in this.
Sadly, no. No. Spider-Man is, but Batman is not.
Okay, well, if it doesn't have Batman and it doesn't have any good recipes in there, it's going to be a hard sell for me.
Fair enough,
Fred.
Fair enough. No, I don't. Yeah, there's no. They don't have a lot of food on the island, so not a lot of recipes going on there.
Matt, you've read 10 Dead Comedians, correct?
Yes, I have. While you guys were talking about food, Fred, you were talking about the phrase square meal, or the book called Square Meal, so I was looking up the origin of that phrase. Apparently, the apocryphal origin of that phrase is that the members of the Royal Navy used to eat on wooden square plates.
Yes.
But mm-hmm. That's actually not the origin of that phrase at all. It is unknown where that phrase started. Anyway... about the book.
Is very good, and it's by, let's see, Jane Siegelman and Andrew Coe.
All right, then check out that. But before you check out that book and get all into cooking, get into what is clearly one of Fred's other big hobbies, passions, comedy, to read 10 Dead Comedians. And Fred, before we get into talking about it, some of the details of the book, I'd be interested to hear what your... elevator pitch summary, if you were selling it at a con, what you would tell people to sell them on it would be, because there's a part of me that feels like as soon as you give away any of it, you're revealing too much.
Too spoilery?
Yeah, because there's a twist like within the first, I don't know, 30 pages.
Sure.
So I'm interested to see how you're selling it to people.
Well, you know, what I generally say is that it's a stand-up murder mystery. It's a stand-up comic. It's like Agatha Christie's classic novel, And Then There Were None, but instead of there being stiff-lipped British people on an island being knocked off by one of them and they're trying to figure out who it is before they're all knocked off, it's a variety of stand-up comedians stuck on a tropical island who are all getting knocked off in extremely ironically appropriate and gory ways, and one of them is the killer, and they've got to figure out who it is before they're all knocked off. Which I guess is maybe the twist you were alluding to in the first 30 pages, but I feel like most people will know that going in.
Yeah, so it's a twist for the characters at the very least, because they think they're going to something totally different, to a career-making situation. And that opening part of the book... Like, each character is introduced in a chapter. Like, we get an idea of who these characters are from the get-go.
Right.
And I got the sense that some of them are very clear analogs for other prominent stand-up comics.
Sure.
And some of them are not, or maybe more of a mix, or are maybe kind of more fully formed creations.
Right.
Like the comic who invites everybody to the island.
Right. Dustin Walker.
Dustin Walker feels like a combination of several different.
Yes.
Sort of biggest comic in the world types.
Yeah. I mean, he was sort of this legend in comedy who ended up doing a bunch of lame family movies and, you know, went from multi-billionaire legend to kind of the butt of jokes.
Like, yeah. And,
dropped from grace. I think everyone listening to this can think of a couple stars off the top of their heads who fit that description.
Well, it made me immediately think of Eddie Murphy, but But there's also another character who's kind of also Eddie Murphy. And, well, and but, like, different aspects of Eddie Murphy.
Right. Well, yeah, the, there's a character who's sort of more of a Kevin Hart type character.
I was thinking of the one who went on to have the talk show, though.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, he's more sort of an analog of, you know, Jay Leno. You know, sort of similar how Jay Leno is not exactly beloved.
Yeah.
In the comedy community once he became head of The Tonight Show and, you know, was still in an era when getting on The Tonight Show could make or break a comic. He became a gatekeeper as well as a comic. And so the folks within the comedy community kind of turned against him. Definitely. Well, that's the TJ Martinez character, yeah.
Well, I don't want to get into, like, reading all your tea leaves, but some of them feel like just particular kind of, like, stereotypes or archetypes or,
sure.
Like, there's types, I guess. Yeah, there's, like, a millennial podcast host who's kind of aggressive. There's, yeah. There's like, almost like a Joan Rivers-type insult comic. Yep. Mm-hmm. I just wonder, like, if you had those sort of direct parallels in mind as you were writing these characters, or if you sort of just let them develop on their own without necessarily being parodies.
Well, I mean, you know, I think what's important is to have all the characters stand on their own without, you know, I didn't want to do like a Romana Clef, something that is like just a one-to-one comparison, and you're supposed to sit there. Like, I didn't want the reader to be distracted sitting there, well, who is this supposed to be? Well, who is this supposed to be? Like, that's not really the mystery you should be focused on so much. Really, I really want people more to be sort of interested in the thriller aspect of it.
Sure.
But, you know, there are certain types in show business. You have the prop comic. You know, there's this character, Orange Baby Man, who's a combination of Carrot Top and the Blue Man Group. Crystal Skillman, my lovely playwright of a wife, was going to work for the Blue Man Group at one point. So she actually got the binder of sort of the philosophy of Blue Man Group. You know, it says something about 21st century clowning, that you can't just be a clown, you have to have a philosophy. So, you know, you read Orange Baby Man has this kind of nutty, kind of innocence philosophy that's kind of questionable in its validity, and the other characters kind of make fun of. You know, there's an Amy Schumer / Sarah Silverman type. There's a, yeah. Like I said, there's a Kevin Hart type. There's a Larry the Cable Guy type. So there's a, you know, blue collar character, and he obviously there's a fun little twist to him where it turns out that he's like a rocket scientist pretending to be a trailer park white trash.
Yeah, I love that gag.
That was
because it escalates the real Larry the Cable Guy story,
right.
You know, to the stratosphere. But, absolutely, like, as I was reading it, I was very invested in the mystery. But I also knew that the end of the book, you know, by the time I get to the end of the book, the mystery would come to a conclusion and would get wrapped up.
Right.
And
necessarily
so,
have that key to the characters.
And so my comedy nerd brain was kind of working on, like, okay, who are these characters supposed to be, or what's their, who's influencing them throughout the whole thing. And they each have very distinct voices, which I think is particularly, I don't know, a tough job for a writer to do when you're essentially having to write, because there's a section of the book where each chapter or every few chapters starts with a routine or a set.
A monologue, yeah.
A monologue, something that a character did on a particular date.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we find out there's a particular reason why we're seeing these particular monologues later, but we're getting these monologues from each character. So you have to replicate stand-up.
Right.
From all these different types of comics and make it believable, funny, and in their voice.
Right. And their inclusion.
Did you agonize over that?
Yeah, no, I did. But I realized the book was going to be too short if I didn't do that. And what was fun is I was able to figure out a way to integrate the monologues. Like, I didn't want to do padding, right? I didn't want to, like, just have, you know, let's stop the plot and let's go to the monologues kind of thing. I wanted to figure out a way to make them integral to the mystery. And once I sort of hit upon that, then I was like, okay, I'm all in. And I sat there and did it. And it was very hard, but it was very gratifying. You know, I was scared to do it, but I think the results or something people are really responding well to, which is terrific.
This is how I'm going to end up relating your book to mine, because I can't not do that.
Okay.
So even though all these characters, all these comics in your book are fictional, and we need to talk about comics calling themselves comics, even though we're in the world of comics.
Sure.
So in the title, they're 10 Dead Comedians and not 10 Dead Comics.
I was promoting this book. I didn't have very many books at Denver Comic Con, but so Quirk Books, my publisher, published these really great coasters.
Yeah.
That I was handing out, and I handed it out to one guy, and he was like, 10 Dead Comedians, you mean like Watchmen? And I was like, what? What do you mean? He's like, the comedian. I'm like, okay. No, not like Watchmen.
Comics fans will figure out.
Superheroes, dude.
Comic fans will figure out a way to relate something back to comics, no matter what you do. In addition to these fictional comedians, there's a world of our comedy. Like, there's real world comedy mixed in here too. Right. Like, yeah. where you know, these characters will mention Richard Pryor and George Carlin,
Bill Cosby, Red Skelton.
Yeah, and talk about, you know, Seinfeld is a show that existed in this world.
Yes.
Even though, you know, TJ Martinez also had his show, and Dustin Walker and Gordo were on their improv show. And so,
which was sort of a whose line is it anyway type monologue.
Yeah. So, like, one of the things when I was writing my, because in my book there's like this history of the world that is supervillain focused, and where supervillains made these particular things happen or change history in different ways, like an alternate history. But then there's like real things in history that happen too. And so I had to kind of find the line of like, okay, what really happened that actually happened in our world too, and what got changed.
Right.
And was that something that was on your mind a lot, about how like you've got this fictionalized world of comedy mixed with the real world of comedy kind of married together?
Well, I mean, you know, at a certain point, whenever you're doing like a fictive world, you know, that isn't, you know, another planet or another, you know, like a fantasy world or something that's completely divorced from our own world, I think to bring the reader in and to have the reader be anchored somehow, the readers and the characters need to have some common frame of reference. So I feel like referencing things like George Carlin and Richard Pryor are common denominators that both the readers and the characters can latch on to. So I think it's important to not sort of say, well, this is a completely divergent timeline where, you know, only my made-up people existed and real people don't, you know. So that was definitely sort of a way for me to kind of have, you know, both sort of Easter egg fans, like Easter eggs for comedy fans, like, you know, there's a room in the mansion, in Dustin Walker's mansion, that has these clown paintings all over them.
Yeah.
Red Skelton, who's the famous clown and comedian and had his own TV show for years, that's what he did when he retired, is he painted all these clowns.
Right.
And so that was sort of and I knew that, and so I thought it'd be an interesting bit to have Dustin Walker own the single greatest collection of Red Skelton paintings in the world, you know. So that was definitely the real world kind of intruding on the fictive world. And I just feel like, you know, we're so wired all the time, and we're so wired into current events and pop culture, it just seems kind of unreal to not reference the real world. It's funny, I'm working on my second novel right now, which is set in the comic book industry and set in San Diego Comic-Con, and we're sort of doing the similar thing where it's like, I was talking to my editor about it, because so there's referencing, there's a lot of fiction, there's a fictional big comic book company and a fictional superhero, but then we also talk about Stan Lee and, you know, Green Lantern exists, and Batman exists, Chris.
Well, we're good.
Sorry, I'm starting to wake Chris up there with the guy.
I'm enjoying the conversation. No, I do have a question though.
This will actually bring Chris back in.
I'm just kidding.
Yes,
for sure. A lot of loving care went into those character monologues that are in here.
Yeah.
It also seems like a lot of loving care went into all the death traps.
Yes, very much so. Perhaps
there we go. You called it, Matt. You called it. I'm back.
So would you say you spent more time crafting those monologues that are very clearly in character voices, or coming up with creative death traps?
Some of the death traps were really hard, but I would definitely say I spent more time on the monologues. Just because, you know, the wrong way to do that would be to make everybody sound like Fred Van Landy, and then that would be a failure. So yeah. I had to spend, I had to rewrite a bunch of those a bunch of times. There's one monologue towards the end that is timed, so I had to time the monologues. I rewrote it, and I have to go through and I have to perform the monologue in my office and kind of sit there with the stopwatch on my phone and kind of get the time exactly right. That was a challenge. That was the challenge of the book, but it was fun and it was super gratifying.
So you mentioned that you're writing your second novel now,
mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I found a little surprising was how timely the references were, considering that I've been involved in publishing.
Right.
I've published a few books.
Right.
And I've gone through a period of several months wondering if people that I mentioned in my book were going to die.
Right.
And suddenly what I wrote would be very morbid and in terrible taste.
Sure.
Instead of a goofy joke. So
there's a great story where Martin Goodman of Timely Comics really wanted to rush out the cover to Captain America Comics number one, where
yeah.
Captain America famously punches Hitler in the face. Like, originally he didn't want to do the cover because he was afraid Hitler would sue them, but then he wanted to rush it out because he was worried that Hitler would be assassinated before the comic came out and they would lose, you know, a considerable amount of revenue. But thank goodness for Martin Goodman. Adolf Hitler never assassinated.
But, like, even though it was, you know, several months ago,
right.
8 or 9 months ago, I was a little surprised that, like, a timely reference, like something to Trump was
yep.
in there.
Yep, and the Cubs winning the World Series.
And the Cubs winning the World Series, yeah. Those were both, like, fairly timely references where I was like, wow, did he guess those? Or were those like, last-minute changes or additions?
No, those were late. The Trump thing was a late addition, like right after the election, and then the Cubs thing was I had to tweak a line.
Yeah. So that was like a fix.
That was a fix. That was definitely a fix. That was something that was already
in. Was there a line in there where it's like, yeah, that's about as likely as the Cubs ever winning the World Series.
Not quite that bad, but
in extra innings.
More or less in that general ballpark, yeah.
Yeah. So I think obviously we have to ask this question. Well, first of all, I have to ask, now that you're one of the comic book writers who is also a novelist, does that make, like, you and Greg Rucka and Brian Michael Bendis and the other members of that club, do you guys get like a special room at Comic Con now where you get to wear like silk robes?
Right.
Or are you guys going to like
fireplace?
Get into a circle and try to knife fight each other? For who gets to be, like, the comic book writer novelist.
I would imagine Neil Gaiman has that crown.
That's probably true.
we would be hard-pressed to knock him off that perch. But, no, it's very cool. It's very cool. I sort of, when I was a kid, being a novelist is kind of what I wanted to be more than anything else. So it's neat to kind of have that dream realized finally. It's very cool.
It's especially interesting considering that you've not only done so many different kinds of comics, like, you know, we talked about Action Philosophers, but we, you know, there's Action Philosophers, there's comic book comics as sort of the nonfiction, sort of easily digestible history stuff. But then there's, you know, all your work in superheroes, and there's all your work in G.I. Joe. And then you were, of course, you know, you mentioned Crystal Skillman earlier, so you were involved in King Kirby, which was a stage play.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have left? Sonnets? Is the Fred Van Lente Book of Poetry coming out soon?
Since this next novel set at a Comic-Con, I've been, you know, I do a lot of Comic-Cons, obviously, and so I've been writing out these notes, and I sort of realized I would like, now kind of what I want to do is I want to do a little, like, chapbook of con haiku. Like, little poems about cosplayers and stuff. Like, drawn from the stuff I've been writing down, just watching people interacting. Going back and forth in front of my table at various Comic Cons around the continent of North America. My favorite, like, overheard thing, just because you start to be attuned to these things. And let's see how you try it. See, I don't want to screw it up. So one of my favorite overheard bits of conversation was this husband and wife are moving in front of the con. They're both very agitated. They're both very upset. The wife turns to the husband and goes, "Well, if I knew where Lou Ferrigno was sitting, we'd be there right now."
Oh, that's
like that.
That's gonna haunt you to the end of your days. Like you're gonna take that one with you wherever you go.
Not only, God willing.
So you're working on a second novel right now.
Mm-hmm.
So are you done with comics, Fred? Are you out of it? Did you escape?
No, not at all. Not at all. I'm doing a lot more stuff for Marvel right now. I'm back with them at the moment. Co-writing something with Greg Pak, my old pal, that'll be announced pretty soon. That's pretty exciting. I'm doing a Guardians of the Galaxy thing, doing a thing for Valiant called War Mother, that sort of post-apocalyptic thing, and that's a lot of fun. And Ryan and I are about to unleash Action Presidents on the world. That'll be coming out in February. Nice little hardback graphic novel biographies of four of your favorite presidents.
Four of mine specifically?
Well, you know, it's sort of a collective you. I can't speak for each individual person's favorite president. Like, one of my favorites is Chester A. Arthur, and he's not in there. So, what are you going to do?
So, do you have to compartmentalize comic writing and prose/novel writing and sort of do one on one day and one on the next, or can you kind of cross-pollinate with the two of them? Do you have to sort of switch gears in your brain for it?
Yeah, well, generally what I have to do is lunch. So
okay.
My day is sort of demarcated. I do thing A in the morning, and then I have lunch and watch my sports talk show that I like, and then I do thing B. And typically, these days, it's one of them is the novel, and one of them is the comic that I'm working on. So that's been cool, that I've been able to kind of, you know, break up my days like that.
Do you decide on a given day, like, what you're going to do? And is it like, okay, if I can get through this next chapter in the novel, I can reward myself with some comics? Or, like, how do you break it up? Like,
well, yeah,
how do you decide?
The other way around. Like, it's, you know, I have a lot of the sort of the grass is always greener kind of syndrome, right? So I get sick of the comics while I'm doing them, and I get sick of the prose while doing them. So it's nice to have one to be the chase or the other. So it's a very good way to make yourself be efficient and productive, and not staring at Twitter all day, which I do anyway. But somehow I manage to eke out what I need to work wise anyway.
That is exciting stuff, Fred, because I am obviously a fan of yours in comics. I'm really looking forward to sitting down with 10 Dead Comedians, giving it a read, especially now that I know there are death traps involved.
Oh my God.
It's
a lot of deaths. All death traps.
after a certain point, yeah, it's a lot of death traps.
Then it should have been called Death Traps, a novel by Fred Vinlandi.
Right? I will inform the marketing team at Workbooks.
Yeah, look.
Very also,
if you want to maybe leave some room at Marvel for other people to get some work, Fred, that's also fine. Now that you're getting these novels going, that's also fine.
I'm not trying to horn an interaction. I swear to God.
I kid. I cannot wait to see what you do next, especially if you and Greg are teaming up.
Yeah, it's fun.
Which is very exciting. But now is the time of the show where we turn the questions over to our listeners on Twitter. And Matt, if people want to get in on these conversations that we have with our friends each and every week, how exactly can they go about that?
Well, Chris, it's easy. Hone your craft. Get a tight five. Hit some open mics. Bomb a few times. You're always going to bomb. You just got to learn how to power through it. Deal with a heckler. You know what I mean? Just deal with a heckler, man.
True.
Then, you know, as you work on your craft and your material gets better and better, you start playing bigger theaters. You headline, right? You're out of the clubs. You're in, like, music venues playing. Then you're playing arenas. Then you go to a death island.
Then you get your sitcom.
Then you get right. First you get your sitcom, then death island. Then when you're on the death island, desperately search for a computer with which you can access the internet.
That's right.
Sign up for an account at twitter.com.
There you go.
Follow the ISB, that's Chris, and the Matt D. Wilson, that's me, and avoid death until Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 6:30 Pacific. One of us will put out the call for questions for our guest, and you will have the opportunity to ask a question, just like the ones you're about to hear for Fred Lev Van Linty, while you're avoiding your untimely demise. And our first question comes from WC Witt at WC underscore WIT, who wants to know, who would win in a Royal Rumble of action philosophers and dead comedians? And you can't say Plato.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that, you know, that a lot of philosophers have a lot of health problems, right? So you've got, like, you know, Descartes had that whole respiratory problem, and, you know, you got a lot of physical issues there, while the comedians tend to have sort of more mental issues. They're right. Very prone to anger. They have low emotion control. So I think we've got to put our money on the comedians because of poor anger management will just cause them to go crazy and just, you know, slap fight the philosophers to death while they're, you know, sucking down their inhalers or whatever they need to do to maintain physical equity.
Well, I can tell you only one comedian that I can think of has Royal Rumble experience, and that's Drew Carey. So,
is that right?
That's right. He was in.
He's in the WWE Hall of Fame, Fred.
He's built for it. I totally believe that.
What year was he in the Royal Rumble, Chris? Like 2001 or two?
I believe it's 2000. It might be 2001. I believe it's 2000.
Okay. Cleveland rocks. Cleveland rocks.
Sure does. Barely Sushi on Twitter, Mike Donahue, has a relevant question to what you heard at Comic-Con a while back. What comedian would you like to see replace the comedian in Watchmen?
That's funny. Who is kind of this kind of weird, like, right-wing kind of nihilistic kind of character. So I guess it's got to be Dennis Miller, right?
It's got to be Dennis Miller. I went right there with you.
Well, Dr. Manhattan, I can't even do a Dennis Miller. And over there, so you don't give me cancer, no.
You'd have to go for, like, an extremely obscure reference about, like a pirate desperately trying to reach the shore or something like that.
Right.
Andrew Sanford, LA underscore rabbit one, has a question that I've been asked several times lately as well, and maybe if you answer it a particular way, Fred, I'll know how to answer it from now on.
Okay.
Andrew wants to know if you have a preferred venue or format that you would wish someone to purchase your book.
That is a great question. I think these days the preferred venue would be a brick-and-mortar store. Just because they buy more copies than they sell, so that's a higher sale than just an individual sale, right? Because and particularly an indie bookstore, although Barnes & Noble's lovely too. The 10 Dead Comedians is available in audiobook and ebook and the classic Dead Tree format.
So do you read the audiobook, Fred?
Well, you don't read an audiobook, Chris. You listen to it.
No, do you read, like, someone reads it out loud, Fred?
I narrate them. I thought that was, like, a weird trick question you're trying to catch me up on. You know, I don't. A great guy, a great narrator named J.D. Jackson reads it. He's terrific. Big thumbs up for him.
Does J.D. do different voices for the different comedians?
He does. He's good.
That's very good. Ben Rowe, cineast Ben Rowe, wants to know, Fred, if you could cast a History of Marvel movie, who would play Kirby, Lee, Ditko, Simon, and Goodman? Which is quite a cast to fill out.
Well, someone, not me, came up with the great idea of posting of having Ray Wise of Twin Peaks fame as Kirby, which is kind of perfect, like, visual casting.
That is very good.
Stan Lee is kind of like the Joker. He's kind of like a hard part to screw up. So, not to denigrate any of the wonderful Stan Lees we've had in all of our many Kirby productions, but pretty much anybody could be Stan Lee because he's such a terrific type. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like, well, this is a good question for you, Chris. Have you ever, like, would you say there's ever been a bad Joker? Like, they're all pretty good in their own way, you know what I mean?
Well, I... Matt has seen Suicide Squad, I have not. So, Matt, maybe you answer that one.
Yeah, wow, I overstepped my bounds there. But his part in the movie's pointless, but he's not necessarily bad in it.
He's doing fine at playing the part he is playing, the version of the Joker he is playing.
And I should say, I was only able to make it through 25 minutes of Suicide Squad on HBO 2 before I realized it was a music video with supervillains as opposed to a movie.
I feel like music video with supervillains makes it sound better than I suspect it is, but yeah.
It helps when you're doing dishes while it's on.
Fred, have you watched...
If I'm doing dishes while Suicide Squad is on, you'll probably enjoy it more.
Fred, have you watched the Netflix original series Glow yet?
I have. I absolutely love it. It's terrific.
Yeah. Mark Maron looks exactly like mid-70s Stan Lee in that show.
Like, I had in my head, like, Willem Dafoe playing Stan Lee, because that would be amazing. But yeah, Mark Maron could really do it,
like,
probably.
Melissa McCarthy could be Stan Lee. Like, I so many people who could do an amazing Stan Lee. You know, Samuel Jackson would be an amazing Stan
Lee. I mean, Jordan Peele has already, shown that he could play Stan Lee.
That's very true. That's very true. So I actually push back. I don't think Maron would be a good Stan Lee simply because he's so angry. Like it's hard for him to, like, Lee, that's not Lee's energy, right? Lee is like, the fun grandfather. You know what I mean? Like, that's his whole kind of shtick, is like, he's more welcoming. And I think Maron's too cranky. Although you're right, they look a lot alike. Ko would be, Ditko's got this kind of Midwest thing going on. So I don't know. I would try to find, like, a William H. Macy type.
Oh, wow.
Without Macy's kind of distinctive look, you'd have to find somebody a little more milquetoast. And I'm kind of blanking right now at a good...
Just a real Jerry Lundegaard refusing to give interviews.
Right. No, I don't, you know... Ayn Rand says I have to be accepted for my value. Yeah, Martin Goodwin... was kind of this pale looking, like, Christopher Walken would be a good Martin Goodman. He's kind of this pale, gaunt dude who sort of notoriously, like, anemic. So yeah, somebody like that, somebody kind of tall and skinny. And I forget what the other one is.
The other one was Joe Simon.
Joe Simon, that's interesting. He's sort of a classic kind of, like, kind of a class, almost a lawyerly type, you know? Like, I don't know. What do you guys think?
I have no frame of reference, really, for who could play Joe Simon, because I don't really have any idea what Joe Simon was like.
Kirby and Lee are so, like, fun to think about because they are such characters, you know? Like just think about the different ways Kirby had been represented.
It would be amazing if we get Johnny Depp to be Stan Lee. That would be amazing. Or like a Nick Cage, like somebody like that. Like somebody
Nick Cage.
That's the energy you're looking for.
I'm really almost ready
to go out of control at any moment.
That's why I went immediately to Willem Dafoe, because I could just imagine, like, his smile getting real big and his eyes getting wide.
Yeah.
Okay.
All these guys we're thinking of are really old.
Well, I mean, Kirby and Lee weren't exactly young when Marvel was really gearing up, so.
Well, true, although Lee was considerably younger and is considerably younger than Kirby is. I mean, he's like 6 or 7 years younger. But yeah, no, you're right. That, I mean, if you're talking about the yeah, I think Lee was like 40 when Fantastic Four number one came out or something like that. It's a great question.
All right. Moving on. The noir guy, Joshua Daniel on Twitter, wants to know, what's your favorite locked room mystery?
In many ways, and then we're down to sort of the classic locked room mystery, just because they're all stuck on the island and one of them is clearly the killer. And it's a great book, you know. It's one of the, like, best selling books of all time, not to mention one of the best selling mysteries of all time. That's it. Yeah, I guess I've been stuck thinking about it, and then there were none for too long because I can't really think of another one that I really like.
I mean, there's always Murder on the Orient Express.
Is that technically a locked prototype mystery, though?
It's a suspects on a train mystery.
Right. Yeah. Well, like, I also like the old, like, logic problem of, like, you know, there's a locked room and there's a dead body in a pool of water, and who did it and what happened? And it's like, oh, it was an icicle, and then it melted.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Logic problem than a story, but anyway.
It's that leg of lamb that got served to the cops.
Right. Stone Cold HCC, who exists only ask questions on War Rocket Ajax.
God bless.
Wants to know, have you ever had to take the kind of medicine that goes in your butt?
Yes, I have.
Fred, I knew you would answer that question. I wouldn't ask that question of everybody, but I knew you would answer it.
Well, you know, you need to put the medicine in your butt. Shit's already gone south. So you are
literally, am I right?
You are looking for relief, and it does not really matter how you get it. So thumbs up for the butt medicine is what I'm saying.
We've got other questions, but this is going to have to be our last one. It's from Sora Nomaru, who wants to know, and this is a big question, but as a comics historian, you might be able to answer it, Fred. In the grand scheme of history, who is or was the most powerful woman in comics that ever lived?
Well, I mean, that's a great question, and fortunately it's a super easy one, and it's also a 10 Dead Comedians related answer, because I named one of the comedians after her. And that's the head of DC Comics in the 70s and 80s, and that's Jeanette Kahn.
Yeah, I thought she might be named after Jeanette Kahn.
Yeah, who single-handedly sort of got, you know, who did a lot of, started a lot of, I mean, in terms of quote-unquote power, she ran the company, so you don't really get much more powerful than that. But she also did a lot of terrific things, like establish and was very good with sort of creator rights in terms of, like, getting people like Jack Kirby, you know, the royalties that he deserved. You know, it was commonly said that you know, Jack Kirby made more money off the Dark Side and Desaad and Calibac toys from the Super Friends line than he ever did from anything he made for Marvel. You know, that was an executive like Jeanette Kahn making that decision, the correct moral decision to do that. You know, she didn't have to do that, but I think she saw what the right thing to do was and went for it. So,
I think there are a lot of candidates for that position. I mean, Jeanette Kahn is probably the right answer, but I also immediately thought of Marie Severin,
sure,
and Flo Steinberg, who probably did more than we'll ever know.
Right, except the Leap still works at Marvel and still a career. At least she was when I started there. I mean, it sort of depends on how you define powerful, right? I mean, you know, what sort of where a lot of Marie Severin's power came from. So Marie's older brother, John, got her a job at DC Comics when she was 21 years old, like right out of college. And so she was the colorist. And so it was really her who decided how much gore was going to be in those comics, right? Because that's sort of how her palette kind of determined, you know, how much of the severed head's bloody stump you would see, you know what I mean? So Al Feldstein actually called her the conscience of DC Comics. So that's pretty powerful. So yeah, she's a pretty good choice.
Yeah, and she did, I feel like Marie Severin did just about everything there was to do in comics.
Right, well, she's probably best known for her work on Hulk as a penciler and doing Not Brand Eck, all those great Marvel parody comics. Apparently, like, she got that job because she was the bullpen artist, which is sort of, you know, the, oh, crap, we need to have something redrawn and we can't get, you know, Gil Kane on the phone or whatever, so give it to the bullpen. And she would draw, like, these like, satirical caricatures making fun of, like, Kirby and Lee and her male coworkers, and I think that's how she ended up with the Not Brand Eck job when Marvel decided to do their mad parody or their mad ripoff.
Well, Fred, we could keep talking about that probably for hours, just like we could comedy and cooking, but
and butt stuff
and butt medicine. But unfortunately, we're out of time. But before we let you go, Fred, please tell everybody not only where they can buy 10 Dead Comedians, which we've talked about a little bit, but also where they can find you online.
You can find me online anywhere under my name, which is Fred Van Lente, and on my Twitter profile, I have a link to the Quirk Books 10 Dead Comedians page, and from there you can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Books a Million or Kindle or iBooks or wherever it is you like to buy books, and that site will tell you exactly where to go get 10 Dead Comedians. greatly appreciate it.
Our guest has been Fred Vinlenty. Fred, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Oh, and the thing I wanted to tell you at the beginning of the interview, 2 days ago, I finally read and finished reading Zero, the biography of a dangerous idea, a book that you recommended on this show back when you were still writing the first arc of Archer and Armstrong.
Yeah, there you go. It's great, right?
Yeah, it's really good. It gets very mathy at the end.
It is. Yeah, I just recommended that. Jody Hauser's doing like the Faith in the Future Force thing, and I was talking to her at Denver Comic Con. I was like, you should read this book, Zero. And she's like, I don't have time. And I'm like, it's really short. But yes, very
short.
Very true.
It's very, like the first few chapters are all history, the last few chapters are all mathy. But Fred, thank you for coming on the show, and I will get around to reading other books you have read sometime within the next 5 years.
That's all I can ask, Chris. Thank you.
Thanks once again to Fred Vinlenty for joining us. He is always a pleasure to have on the show, and his new book sounds delightful. So everyone should go pick that up.
Very much so. It's a great read, and I would encourage anyone to read it, as they also read my book, Supreme Villainy.
A great book that is delightful.
Thank you, Chris. This question, we're doing listener questions now, by the way. Would you like to hear a listener question, Chris?
I would love to hear a listener question. These are the questions for us sent in by listeners either through email to warrocketpodcast@gmail.com or on warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com, where we occasionally answer questions.
I put the cart before the horse a little bit there, and I apologize.
A little bit, but it's okay. Look, it's fine. It's late for us.
Yes. This question comes from Jonathan Stewart, sent in via email, and he's got a question about our Every Story Ever rankings, which I think is an interesting question.
Okay.
He says, so Holy Terror ranked crazy low due to its crazy politics, which is legit. But Fables did pretty well, and while the arc you ranked isn't too bad, Bill's right-wing politics, Bill Willingham's right-wing politics, formed the backbone of the series. And then you discover that the whole thing is an allegory for Israel. Not that I have any problems with Israel. I just don't think anyone who disagrees with what they do is the dark adversary. So how do you draw that line? How do you make that distinction? And I guess my answer to that is I never thought about Israel reading Fables.
Did you not think about it when Big B Wolf started talking about Israel?
Okay.
About 30 issues in?
Okay, yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah, because that did happen.
Yeah. I mean, look, I do not think that Palestine is comparable to a dark adversary by any stretch, with the exception of the one time it is explicitly, that connection is explicitly made. I feel like you can get through Fables pretty easily without making that connection at all, whereas Holy Terror is impossible to read as anything but what it is.
I mean, the real world geopolitical stuff is stuff that I think is beyond the scope of the Every Story Ever list in most cases.
Yeah.
In Holy Terror, it's unavoidable.
Yes.
Because it's not the subtext, it's not layered in metaphor, it is the explicit text. And one of the things that made Holy Terror such a bizarre experience to read was that the actual explicit text of Holy Terror then goes in, takes this weird left turn into something truly bizarre and incomprehensible. There's not a baseline level of craft to it after a certain point. Like there's a hard turn where that book gets really weird and difficult on a purely technical level, like divorced from the content, it just goes haywire on us.
Well, yeah, that's part of it. Like, if you remove the geopolitics from Holy Terror, or you remove the political slant from it, it's an absolute mess of a comic book.
Yes.
Whereas I feel like you can read Fables. Like, any comparison to real-world politics in Fables is definitely the weakest thing about it. Fables does a good job of creating its own world and its own compelling characters and telling a story that works whether or not you think about Fabletown as Israel. and I would prefer not to.
There's a conversation to be had about separating the art from the artist. But I think that conversation that we have isn't Frank Miller versus Bill Willingham. It's Frank Miller versus Frank Miller. You know, like, we know a lot about Frank Miller these days. But at the end of the day, like, Batman Year One is still, like, the number two story on our list. It's still one of my favorite comics of all time. There's a lot of good Frank Miller comics out there. They're honestly, they're hard to look at sometimes in the context of later work. I grew up in the 90s as a Batman fan. I've read a lot of Chuck Dixon comics that I think on a level now are difficult for me to go back to. There are also, like, plenty of creators that I 100% agree with in a political arena that I'm not a fan of their comics. Like, specifically with regards to the political subtext of Fables, I think what makes it work is that it is subtext. And again, it is explicitly stated. And we do have, like, you know, Bill Willingham. Like we talked about the one-act play. There's stuff out there. Yeah. And I don't think you and I are up for or interested in or really capable of telling anybody else where their event horizon should be in terms of separating the art from the artist. You know, like, that's not a thing we want to talk about. We talk about it when it's unavoidable. In Holy Terror, it's unavoidable. Fables, there's a level of craft and a level of viewing things through a lens that I think makes it, it takes it a step removed, two steps removed from real world politics. And honestly, like, I don't think the politics of Fables, what is explicit in the text, are bad. I don't think they're abhorrent to me in the way that, like, the politics of the people behind stories might be.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a line everybody has to draw for themselves. And where we that draw the line isn't necessarily where you would draw the line, but we can't ignore when that line is crossed. And we can't falsely say someone has crossed the line for us when they kind of haven't. Or when it's easier to ignore, you know, the inspiration for something. Because, again, I think you can ignore the inspiration for Fables.
I don't even know if it's necessarily a matter of ignoring it as much as, even if you have a creator, like, explicitly stating something about their work and their inspiration, I think the lens with which they craft it becomes, you know, really interesting and can affect the book. Like, I think spoiler, Stephanie Brown, like, I made a lot of jokes about Stephanie Brown, but I think she's an interesting character. Stephanie Brown is also a character that very explicitly is a, you know, gets pregnant as a teenager and has a baby because, you know, Chuck Dixon was a guy who didn't believe in abortion. That's the kind of impetus that led to that. That doesn't mean that, like, I think it's bad that Stephanie Brown was pregnant and had a baby, because, you know, it gets increasingly weird the further you to discuss, the further you remove it from reality. And Fables is so weirdly removed in that way because it's about fairy tale characters, and because there's such a high level of craft going into it that Holy Terror doesn't have. That Holy Terror is explicitly about one specific thing in every way that's really hard to get through.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a very thought-provoking question, and again, we absolutely don't want to, like, quash debate over this, but I think it comes down to what speaks to you about a work.
I mean, if anything, I think we're inviting more debate, or inviting people to make their own distinctions and draw their own lines, because
yeah.
You can't have anybody draw that line for you. You have to kind of discover what the line is for you.
Yeah.
All right. Here, one more question. This one is not as serious. This is from The Velez on Tumblr, who asks, if Batman went around the world and studied everything, does that mean he also has the best vape tricks?
Oh. Oh, that's a real hard one to answer, Matt.
Chris, the answer is yes.
I mean, yeah, I know the answer is yes. Matt, can I ask you a question about Batman?
Okay.
Did he vape?
He does, but only because when he's got to go out on the streets in disguise, he's got to convincingly, you know, show those other goons out there on the street. You know, when he's out there being Matches Malone, he's gotta like be like, check out my rig. Look how cool Matches Malone's vape rig is. And then he'll do some rings or something. You know Matches Malone vape.
His name's gonna be Vape Malone by the end of the decade.
Cotton Malone.
Vape Tricks Malone. Please, hey, DC Comics, I know we've said some things, but please hire me and Matt to do an original graphic novel about Batman going undercover as Vape Tricks Malone. Thank you in advance. Sincerely, Chris Sims.
That's going to do it for our listener question segment. If you would like to send us a listener question, you can do so on our Tumblr, which is warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com, or by email at warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That email address is also where you can send Every Story Ever lists and panel president lists. If you want to sponsor the show, you can let us know there. Or if you just want to drop us a line about something else, you can do so at that very email address. Check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can stream the show, download the show, read show notes, and leave comments. And check us out on Apple Podcasts. If you like the show, leave us a review there. Because the more positive reviews we get on Apple Podcasts, the more we are featured. Now we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us online. For me, all you have to do is go to mattdwilson.net and find links to all my stuff. Chris, where can people find your stuff?
Everybody can go to the-isb.com to find links to my stuff, the comics that I write, the columns that I write around the web, and the podcast that I do, both with Matt and with some other podcasting partners. Head to your local comic book store, and you can get the all-new Guardians of the Galaxy Annual 2017, which should still be on shelves. It's a tie-in to Secret Empire, but that's just the backdrop for a really, really fun cosmic adventure story that Chad and I wrote. Chad Bowers and I wrote with art by Danilo Bayreuth and coloring by Tamara Bonvillain that is truly beautiful and made us so happy to see when that book came out. Plus Deadpool Bad Blood, still available. Other stuff, Sword Quest, Army of Darkness, all that stuff's out and continuing to come out. So keep an eye out because it's very good. That's it. That's all I got. Matt, before we wrap up, we've been trying to put the spotlight on a couple of charities as the year has gone on. Some good causes that you can throw your money to. The one that we wanted to talk about this week is one that you can actually get something in return from. It's always good to donate money to causes, but if you want to get a little something extra yourself, there's nothing wrong with that either. And that's why I think it's really important to direct people to the current Humble Bundle, which is Jack Kirby and Will Eisner themed. There's some really, really great Kirby and Kirby adjacent content in there, including the Captain Victory miniseries that Joe Casey wrote that has some Dan McDade in it as well as some other stuff. It's got some of the Dynamite Kirby Genesis stuff in there too. But it's also got some Kirby work that's a little more obscure. Silver Star, for instance, is in there, and there's a couple issues of the Jack Kirby Collector. Those Joe Simon Jack Kirby romance comics that are surprisingly fun to read in the way that old romance comics often are. And you can get everything for $15, which is more than worth it. And that supports the CBLDF and the Hero Initiative, two causes that I think we've cited before as being really near and dear to us as comics creators.
Absolutely. And as Chris said, you know, you get lots of cool stuff in with that. Like, you know, in addition to the Kirby stuff, a bunch of Will Eisner stuff, too. Some Spirit comics, some Will Eisner tribute stuff, Last Day in Vietnam, a whole bunch of stuff that is maybe not the most common Jack Kirby and Will Eisner work you're going to find out there. Some stuff that's a little more buried treasure that's really cool.
Yeah, and it's got, we talked a lot about Mage earlier in the show. It's got that Matt Wagner, Dan Schkaid, Will Eisner is the Spirit series that we both really, really liked as it was coming out.
The Dynamite series.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So go pick up that Humble Bundle. For $15, you get all that stuff.
Yeah. And get ready to celebrate Jack Kirby's 100th birthday next month. We're going to be doing some hardcore partying, I think. Both good causes, all good comics. Check them out. Matt, that does it. This has been Ajax, what is it, 361?
361.
361. How did we do? Did we do good this week? I feel good about it.
Well, okay, I got my decoder ring here, and I'm going to decode the code of 361, okay?
Okay.
So let me see. 3 corresponds to...
Is it that the 3-6 Mafia is the one rap group that we constantly referenced when we were in Seattle together this year? I mean, is that
did,
it?
We did do that. Let's see. 3 corresponds to H, 6 corresponds to Q, and 1 is C, the solutions, HQC.
Oh, high quality content.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a relief.
See you, everybody. We love you.
Yeah!